Well, good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming tonight. I assume you just needed someplace warm to go tonight so you could get in out of the cold. Finally, we've reached this point where we have some decent temperatures. We're going to take a break for a few weeks, and then we'll resume our series, Constitutional Conversation. So we'll send out email announcements. So if you haven't signed in before you leave tonight, Kelly has a sheet. So please do that. I do want to make another announcement that I hope will be of interest to you. On May 17, the Alturas Institute will host a dinner program at University Place, and it's called Conversations with Remarkable Women. And the theme of the program is finding your voice. And we're going to feature some local women who are indeed remarkable, and we're bringing in two foreigners, that is, Californians, of great national prominence, who will talk about this issue that resonates across the country. I hope the timing is very good for this kind of program, as women everywhere are finding their voices in all kinds of arenas, from politics to journalism to industry and so forth. And so we'll send out an email blast, and we'll run a couple of newspaper ads beginning next week. The ticket price will be $35, and that will cover dinner and the program. And you'll have a couple of different ways of reserving seats. One will be, beginning May 1, you can purchase tickets through PayPal, through the Alturas website, which we've been working on and will be back up and running on May 1. Or, if you prefer, you can simply email in your names to make a reservation or call the number on the website. So lots of different ways. I hope that will be of interest to you. So tonight's final session in this series of four lectures and conversations about constitutional topics focuses on what most people will agree was a great American invention, an American contribution to the world of law and jurisprudence. And the subject tonight is equal protection under the law. It is justly regarded as an American contribution to the world of jurisprudence. At least Charles Sumner, the great abolitionist, who fought very hard for liberation of African Americans in the antebellum period, and introduced what became the Civil Rights Act of 1875, said on the floor of the Senate that in fact we needed in this country to have equality before the law. And he thought himself that that was the first time that that phrase had ever been injected. So he was giving himself a little pat on the back. In reality, it was true that the concept of equality before the law was an American contribution to the world of jurisprudence. But if we turn back the clock a few centuries, we can find the germs of that idea. For example, in 1690, John Locke, the great English philosopher, had written that all government should promulgate laws that are generally applicable to everybody. So not quite capturing the principle of equal protection, but setting forth the idea that all laws should be generally applicable. And then his fellow Englishman, the great Sir William Blackstone, the great scholar, writing in his magisterial three-volume work on commentaries on English law, published in 1765, said that when restraints on individuals are imposed, they should be applied equally. So you can see some great jurists and philosophers looking in that direction of equal protection of the law. But it is, in fact, found for the first time in an American document in the 14th Amendment, which we will this summer, on July 28th, celebrate the 150th anniversary. 150 years of the great concept of equal protection of the law. So tonight we want to talk about what that concept means, how it evolved during the drafting of the 14th Amendment, how the Supreme Court has interpreted it. Now, this is a big subject. We would require probably 15 weeks to adequately discuss it. But we'll do that because we're sharp folks. We're going to do that in just 40 minutes or so. That's all we need. So the idea behind the Equal Protection Clause was generated from the antebellum period in the run-up to the Civil War and, of course, the effort to patch the nation together. During the Reconstruction period, when America is being reconstructed after the Civil War, you may recall, Congress passed three constitutional amendments that tried to place blacks on par with whites in the eyes of the law. So the first great Reconstruction Amendment was the 13th Amendment, ratified in 1865. And you recall, this is the amendment that abolished slavery. So that represented a great leap forward. It was, in fact, the handiwork of Abraham Lincoln, who had set it in motion. But of course, he died before he had the opportunity to see the fruits of his labor. You'll recall that Lincoln had issued the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, but not everybody realizes that that had limited application. Lincoln had no authority as President of the United States to abolish slavery for all African Americans, but just for those who lived in states that were in rebellion against the Union. So it had a tremendous effect because it deprived the southern states of a great labor pool. And secondly, once freed, many began to fight for the northern army, and that gave the north, again, a distinct advantage. But again, it was limited. So he began to work toward what he hoped would be universal abolition, but as we noted, he died before that could become law. But once the 13th Amendment was ratified, people realized, well, that doesn't get the United States where it needs to be, because to simply abolish the formal chains of slavery does not put this nation anywhere near the concept of equality for the newly freed man. Hence, we begin to turn our attention to the 14th Amendment, ratified on July 28, 1868, which does try to put the newly freed man on the same legal plane as white Americans. Now, consider for a moment just how huge a task this is, to move from a nation filled with slavery, in which racism is prevalent. Imagine the leaders of the Republican Party, known as the Radical Republicans, who are writing the 13th and the 14th Amendments, and they'll write the 15th Amendment, which, of course, extends the right to vote to the newly freed man. But imagine the few radical Republicans who are very much in power in the Senate, trying to push the nation forward to the point where we can eliminate all badges and incidences of slavery. Not simply content to eliminate the formal chains of slavery, because you couldn't see, it was one thing to free African Americans from the chains of slavery, but if they were plunged into a society in which there was profound and pervasive racism, there would be nothing like equality, and they could be as equally exploited to every degree as they were before the 13th Amendment. So Charles Sumner, as I mentioned earlier, the great abolitionist who throughout his lifetime was committed to trying to achieve legal equality for blacks and whites, worked very hard on the amendment, as did a few people from particular states, one of whom was Howard Bingham from Michigan, another was a man named Jacobs, and there were about six or seven senators who did the hard work. What they were after was to make it not only illegal, that is, unconstitutional, for all governments to deny the equal protection of the law, but to actually take the very radical step of prohibiting individuals from practicing racism in the form of denying services, public accommodations, inns, theaters, restaurants, carriage services to the newly freedmen. This was, in fact, a cultural, legal, and social revolution that they envisioned. That's pretty incredible. As they got through the drafting part of the 14th Amendment, they provided finally, in the language that of the 14th Amendment, that no state shall make or enforce any law denying any person the privileges and immunities of citizenship, due process of law, and the equal protection of the laws. They thought that the equal protection of the clause, equal protection clause, would in fact serve their great goal of putting blacks and whites on par in the eyes of the law. When they drafted that language and the states ratified it, we could see what I call a revolution, the second revolution in America. The 14th Amendment effectively tried to change the nature of our legal history in a couple of profoundly important ways. First, by virtue of the fact that Congress in Section 5 of the 14th Amendment would have the authority to enforce those guarantees of due process, privileges and immunities, and equal protection, that Congress could pass laws to enforce those guarantees by overriding state laws, which might still be clinging to the past in an effort to further promote deprivation of rights for the newly freedmen. That was critical for Congress to do so, because if Congress could not pass laws to stop states from discriminating against African Americans, then states would continue to do so, meaning the perpetuation of racism, segregation, you name it. But when Congress did reserve that grand power to itself through Section 5, it was performing a historic transformation of federalism in this country. Up until that point, it had always been understood that states would decide for themselves how to promote the health, morals, welfare, and safety of their people. That was the police power. But essentially, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment was moving the police power of the states to Congress, moving it from the state level to the federal level, working a tremendous upheaval in our understanding of what federalism is about. It's true that states would retain those powers, but the key is Congress would have an overriding authority. Congress could scour the books for laws in states which would in any way deny equal protection or due process or privileges and immunities of citizenship to the newly freedmen. That scared the southern states to no end, as you can imagine, and it also upset many in the country who had been accustomed to the idea that the states had retained a great deal of authority, and now this was a dramatic shift of the state police power from states to Congress. But they succeeded in passing it. Here was the great revolutionary 14th Amendment in operation. But as we all know, it's one thing to write an amendment. It's one thing to write any clause or provision of the Constitution. The key is, how is it implemented? How is it followed or not followed? How is it interpreted? How do the courts interpret it? How does Congress interpret it? How might the president interpret it? The same men who wrote the 14th Amendment wrote the 1875 Civil Rights Act, one of the great civil rights acts in American history. Indeed, a far-reaching effort to implement the goals of the 14th Amendment, due process, equal protection, and so forth. This was the last shining act of the radical Republicans, because they would lose power in the next election, and they would be replaced by much more moderate, indeed conservative people, who would not have their same passion for reconstructing the Union along lines that would attempt to eliminate the badges, the incidences, the vestiges of racism. Consider what the 1875 Civil Rights Act attempted to do. It prohibited private individuals, owners of inns, theaters, carriage services, and the like, from denying their services to the newly freedmen. Thus, private individuals would be prohibited under the federal law from practicing racism and denying African Americans from their shops and their businesses. That was sweeping. That was radical. That was attempting not only to effectuate legal change, but to build into our culture and indeed our social relations a sense of equality before the law. This effort was so important to Congress that it took the extraordinary step of writing a provision into the statute that said the Attorney General of the United States is personally liable to enforce the statute. Now, it's not necessary to say that, you would think, because that's the job of the Attorney General. But so concerned were these members of Congress to be sure that the Attorney General would implement this statute that they provided, A, he was personally liable, and this meant that he could be sent to prison for failure to enforce it, and he would have to pay a hefty fine of about $20,000. $20,000 today is a lot of money. Imagine how much that was in 1875, probably $250,000 or more. Now, how do you get the attention of the Attorney General any more quickly than that? By saying you will enforce it, and if you don't, you're going to go to prison, and you're going to be fined a princely sum of money. This statute was challenged by a number of business owners who did not want to comply with it. And in the civil rights cases of 1883, the Supreme Court interpreted the statute, the 1875 Civil Rights Act, and struck it down, exercised their power of judicial review to strike down the Civil Rights Act, holding that Congress, in passing the statute, had exceeded its authority, that Congress does not have authority to impose legal requirements on individuals, or let me say more clearly, does not have the legal authority to impose prohibitions on individuals. Why not? Because the court said, look at the language of the 14th Amendment. It says, quote, no state shall make or enforce any law denying any person due process, privileges and immunities, and equal protection of the law. The court said the 14th Amendment has no language prohibiting individuals from denying their businesses and their services to the newly freedman. So the court very narrowly interpreted that statute to strike it down, and that was tragic for the history of America's racial relations, because we would not have any additional significant civil rights legislation for 100 years until the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Think of the damage that was done to this nation by virtue of the Supreme Court's decision in striking down the statute, saying, in effect, it's okay for individuals to practice racial discrimination if they choose. The court was giving a blank check to individuals to practice racial discrimination. If the court had upheld the statute and the Attorney General enforced it, we could only imagine that the Attorney General would under those penalties, think about how our racial history might have been radically different, because we would have been prosecuting people, owners of businesses, in 1883 for failing to admit persons of color to their business. If we had done that, for 10 years and 20 years and 30 years and 40 years, we could have made tremendous progress, I think, in this country. So we want to ask the question, why in the world did the Supreme Court strike down that statute? I've already told you that it looked very closely at the language, which only prohibited states from denying equal protection and due process of law. The other reason, and the overarching reason, is the Supreme Court did not want to preside over the radical transformation of federalism, which the 14th Amendment had engineered. Through Section 5, Congress having the authority to pass laws to override state laws, thus transferring the state police power to the federal government. The court did not want to play that historic role. It noted that point in several companion cases involving other issues. Well, what does this mean? This means that the court decided that it was going to ignore the mandates of the 14th Amendment and to ignore the requirements of the 1875 Civil Rights Act, both of which were written by the same men who wrote the 14th Amendment, we would presume, then had the best knowledge of what that amendment meant when they wrote the 1875 Act to implement it. Under a historic constitutional doctrine of interpretation called the rule of Stuart versus Laird, going back all the way to 1803, the Supreme Court has said that the court is duty-bound to interpret a constitutional provision in light of the understanding of a Congress contemporaneous with the framing of that constitutional provision. So if we applied that historic rule of Stuart versus Laird, which has never been overturned 200 years later, it would have meant that the court would have said, aha, we see that the very same Congress, the same men who wrote the 14th Amendment were the same men who wrote the 1875 Act. Thus, if we apply the rule of Stuart versus Laird, we would say to ourselves, here is a Congress in 1875 that is contemporaneous with the framing of the 14th Amendment. We will defer to that Congress. Why? Because under the reasoning of Stuart versus Laird, they best knew what that amendment meant because they wrote it. The court under Stuart versus Laird would have said that an interpretation of a constitutional provision by a Congress contemporaneous with its framing is, quote, too strong and obstinate to be controlled. That's the essence of Stuart versus Laird, which has stood at the foot of great Supreme Court landmark decisions. But what the court did, and this is the point I really want to drive home, the court assumed power unto itself to ignore the historic aims of the 14th Amendment and then to ignore the statute that would have effectuated perhaps history's most dramatic, monumental Civil Rights Act. But when the court struck it down, as I say, it now paved the way for private individuals to feel free to practice racial discrimination. What a historic moment. We would say that was what we call the court's decision is what we would call an exercise in conservative judicial activism. The court claiming for itself the power to ignore constitutional mandates to achieve its own ideology, to achieve its own end. Tragic, as I say. But matters got worse. In the civil rights cases of 1883, the court essentially ignored the great thrust of the Equal Protection Clause, equality before the law for all people. It gets worse because a decade later, and some of you have heard of this case, in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. One of the worst decisions, one of the most infamous decisions, one of the most pernicious decisions ever rendered by the Supreme Court. The court held that segregation is constitutional. It does not violate the Equal Protection Clause so long as the separate places or facilities are equal. This is known as the infamous separate but equal doctrine. So let's understand what Plessy versus Ferguson was about, and we'll see how the court interpreted, or I would say misinterpreted, the Equal Protection Clause. Again, bearing in mind that the idea of equal protection is to apply the law in the same way to all people, as Andrew Jackson would say back in 1832, by the way, when he vetoed the National Bank Bill, he said that our law should be equally applied to all people, the poor as well as the rich. When he said that in 1832, bless you, he was anticipating what the framers of the 14th Amendment would try to achieve. But the Supreme Court threw that out the window in the civil rights cases of 1883 when it struck down the 1875 Civil Rights Act, and it again trampled on equal protection in Plessy versus Ferguson. In Louisiana at that point in time, there were separate railroad cars for blacks and whites. Whites in one car, blacks in another car. A man named Homer Plessy, who was described as, quote, 1/8 black, refused to, I don't know how, described as 1/8 black, was sitting in the car reserved for whites. The conductor told him he needed to leave. He argued that under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, he had the same right to sit in that car as all whites did. Well, you can imagine, he was arrested. The case, Plessy versus Ferguson, emerges and it goes all the way to the Supreme Court. In the court's opinion, written by a justice named Brown, Justice Brown introduced the infamous separate but equal doctrine, saying that so long as the facilities reserved for blacks on the one hand, whites on the other, are quote-unquote equal, then there is no violation of the Equal Protection Clause when the state proceeds with segregation. Separate but equal. Justice Brown took note of the complaint of Homer Plessy, that in fact it is relegating blacks to second-class citizenship because they're being told that they're inferior, not good enough to sit in the same car with whites, not good enough to mix in society. And Justice Brown said, in effect, in what I regard as the coldest sentence that I've ever read, written by a Supreme Court justice, he said, if blacks have that problem, then it's their problem, they're too thin-skinned. They need to realize that whites don't want to mix with blacks. Isn't that an amazing statement by a Supreme Court justice? So the introduction of separate but equal then would allow states, any level of government, to generate separate facilities, thus hardening the differences, further entrenching the racism that had undergirded American law since the very founding of the nation, since African slaves were first brought to American shores, erasing all the progress of the 14th Amendment. What 14th Amendment? Of the Civil Rights Act and the other statutes trying to fight against racial discrimination. There was one famous dissenting opinion in that case. John Marshall Harlan, the son of slave owners from Kentucky, wrote a grand dissent in which he condemned the court for its majority opinion. And he said, the Constitution is colorblind. The Constitution is colorblind. Shame on the court for bringing its shades of color into the interpretation of the 14th Amendment and the practices in Louisiana. And then he predicted that history will in fact shame the Supreme Court for its decision in Plessy versus Ferguson. How wise those words were, because to get slightly ahead of the story, his dissenting opinion in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896 would become law of the land in the great civil rights case of Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954, when the court proceeds to strike down segregation in public schools. Back to that in a moment. Unfortunately, tragically, when the Supreme Court introduced separate but equal, it paved the way for states to practice segregation. And the concept of separate but equal facilities was a cruel hoax, just a joke, because the separate facilities for blacks and whites were never equal after that decision. Not with respect to medical care, not with respect to schools, for example, and in other ways. And this is the period of time over the next several decades when we see all those signs in southern cities and in northern cities providing, here's a drinking fountain for blacks and a drinking fountain for whites, and so on and so forth. The hardening produced by segregation and the Supreme Court's decision, which again, I emphasize, was at odds with the 14th Amendment, led the NAACP, beginning in the 1920s, to bring legal battles to try to chip away at separate but equal. And in the 1930s, two young attorneys who led the way for the NAACP, one was known as Thurgood Marshall, and the other was Charles Houston, very, very brilliant attorneys who fought hard to win cases, and they did prevail in federal courts in the 30s and the 40s, arguing to the courts that separate schools, for example, in South Carolina were not comparable to the schools for whites. And if separate but equal is the law, they argue, then the court has to hold those southern cities to that law. And so judges would begin to say in a number of cases covering a variety of areas that indeed school districts are required to provide equal schools for blacks, equal to the whites. But that too was a hoax. Why? Because then the courts would say, but you don't have to do it right now. We'll give you 20 or 25 years to bring the facilities up to speed. If you think about 20 to 25 years, that's about five generations of students, isn't it? All those years. So even though they were winning victories, the NAACP attorneys, a great discussion began to ensue within the organization about whether or not they could actually make progress if they continued to follow this path, because they regarded these victories as, quote, moral victories or hollow victories. And how are these decisions, how will these victories ever improve the quality of life for our children and for African Americans everywhere? So in the late 40s, after they had won victories knocking down, or after they had won victories in which the courts would require in theory that school districts would have to be equal, that law schools would have to be equal, that medical schools would have to be equal, and so forth, they finally decided, after a great debate, a very candid, robust debate, that in fact the NAACP would switch its legal strategy and it would now try to knock the ball out of the park by challenging separate but equal head on. This came at great risk, everybody understood, and that's why there was such a great debate within the organization for a long time. It was such a robust debate that some people who lost walked away. And there were people who worried that the white benefactors would not want to support an effort to strike down separate but equal, because to some of them, separate but equal was okay. They just wanted separate facilities. To others who were more committed to equality, separate but equal had to go. So they lost some members, they lost some money, but they were to proceed. Why was it such a risk? Because Marshall and Houston and others realized that if they went to the court and argued that separate but equal is unconstitutional, and the court upheld separate but equal, that is, upheld Plessy versus Ferguson, now 60 years old, that would reaffirm, they feared, that this is the law of the land, making it doubly difficult to ever strike down again. Would we have to wait another half century before challenging it? So it came at a risk. But they decided to go forward because their progress was moving at glacier-like speed. Not glacier-like speed in the era of global warming, but back when we didn't have global warming, that was really slow. So they decided to find plaintiffs, try to find plaintiffs who would bring suits against school districts and against other organizations. It was not easy to find plaintiffs. Thurgood Marshall would drive through southern cities approaching people who were the victims of segregation and ask, would you join a lawsuit? So often they wanted to, but they couldn't risk it because they knew if they joined a lawsuit, they would lose their jobs. If they didn't have income, they couldn't pay the rent, couldn't buy food, their family would really suffer. Worse than that, they knew, and many were, beaten up, physically assaulted, if in fact they joined a lawsuit. So this put potential plaintiffs, all black Americans, in the most excruciating circumstances. Shall I join a suit because it's the only way to break the back of Plessy versus Ferguson, but it comes at great personal risk and risk to the welfare of my family? What to do? Eventually, Marshall was able to find 7 or 8 plaintiffs scattered around the South, and one of the plaintiffs, given permission by her parents, was 10-year-old Linda Brown of Topeka, Kansas. And when the court collects several different cases bringing the same issues, they just identify one of the plaintiffs and put his or her name on the case. This, folks, is how you achieve immortality. Your name is on a landmark Supreme Court case. It's Linda Brown. It's Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, which had been engaged in segregation, as had so many other places around the country. So, Brown versus the Board of Education comes before the Supreme Court in 1953. After oral argument, that is, when the attorneys present their respective arguments to the court, Justice Robert H. Jackson suffers a heart attack. He is unable to participate in the case. From the standpoint of supporters of Linda Brown, that was probably a good thing. Why? Because he was likely to adhere to the precedent of Plessy versus Ferguson. Jackson is often regarded as one of the great jurists in our history, certainly one of the best writers, but he was very much given to embracing precedents. And so that meant probably a losing vote for Linda Brown, meaning affirmation of Plessy versus Ferguson if he'd been able to participate. He's in the hospital. Some of those on the court who very much wanted to strike down Plessy believed that, in fact, what we needed to do now was to have re-argument on a couple of the issues, and that would mean that the court could consider the case again. So the argument, the second argument, the sequel, so to speak, ensues months later, and the attorneys for both sides are asked to brief the purposes or the intentions of those who framed the 14th Amendment. The real strategist behind this was Justice Frankfurter, who wanted to make sure that there was time to delay the case. This was very significant because while the court was now pondering the what to do with this case, the Chief Justice, Fred Vinson, dies. Vinson had been an advocate of retaining Plessy versus Ferguson. Bad news for Linda Brown and those wanting racial equality. Frankfurter, who was not one to mince words and was known to be Machiavellian, smiling at your face while he inserted the knife, when he was told about Vinson's death by his law clerk, Frankfurter said, quote, "This is the first evidence I've ever had of the existence of a God," end quote. Now, folks, just so you know, and for the students here, that's now how you want to be remembered by your colleagues someday when you get a job. But what it meant then was there was now suddenly a vacancy on the Supreme Court of the United States. The president, the newly elected president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, would have the opportunity to fill that vacancy. He would have the opportunity to nominate somebody to replace Fred Vinson. Eisenhower had won a narrow battle in the 1952 Republican primary, and he had been aided by the governor of California, a man named Earl Warren, who at the convention had thrown his California delegation behind Eisenhower and helped Eisenhower win the primary. Therefore, Eisenhower thought, I'm indebted to Earl Warren. I need to repay this debt. Thus, when he began to think about who might succeed Fred Vinson as Chief Justice, he turned to Earl Warren, who had earlier been the Attorney General for the state of California. And so he nominated Earl Warren despite the fact that people close to him, including his own vice president, Richard Nixon, to whom he would become related later through a marriage, said, I know Earl Warren. You do not want him on the Supreme Court. He is not the dyed-in-the-wool conservative Republican that you think he is. He's not to be trusted. And a couple of other people warned him. But Eisenhower, even in those days, wasn't about to trust the advice of his vice president, Tricky Dick Nixon. So he proceeded, nominated him, and Warren is, of course, approved by the Senate. Now he comes to the Supreme Court. This will be his first case. How about that? Your first case on the Supreme Court, taking up the greatest of all civil rights cases ever heard in American history. The court goes into conference, they're having discussions. Earl Warren was not a great legal scholar. His great admirers will be the first to say that. He was a very adroit politician with a sense of justice when it came to racial discrimination toward African Americans. Sadly, he did not have that kind of equanimity when it came to Asian Americans, because when he was Attorney General in California, after FDR's Executive Order 9066, ordering the removal of Japanese American citizens from their homes, Earl Warren was a champion of that. So how to explain this man's racial bias toward Japanese Americans, but not against African Americans? That's one complex person. Let's just leave it at that. Complicated. At any rate, in what has been described as one of the great political moments in the history of the court, you had some of the great advocates as justices serving on the court, including Felix Frankfurter and William Brennan, who decided that they could work, that is, massage the other justices to come around to their perspective, to try to persuade them to, in fact, overturn Plessy versus Ferguson, thus striking down separate but equal. So you had this great moment The justices are visiting each other in their respective chambers, lobbying. And it became clear after Warren was lobbying, after Brennan was lobbying, after Frankfurter was lobbying, that they now were going to secure a majority to overturn Plessy and to relegate separate but equal to the ash can of history. But it wasn't going to be enough to have a majority based on, say, a 6-3 vote or even a 7-2 vote, because Warren and others recognized if we have a split vote, it's simply going to encourage advocates of segregation to bide their time, keep working against whatever decision we render, and that will undermine what we hope will be a bold stroke for equal protection of the laws. So they finally turned to a couple of Southerners who had to make, Southerners on the Supreme Court who had to make the hard decision to, in fact, ignore their family history, their cultural history, and to vote in favor of striking it down. And there was Justice Jackson, who now had the opportunity from his hospital bed to make it unanimous, 9-0, or would he leave it at 8-1? So imagine this scene, fellow justices going in to talk to Bob Jackson and trying to persuade him. I don't know if anybody said either you sign or you don't get this water, sign or you don't. I don't know if they did that, I just don't know. At any rate, Jackson did vote finally with the majority to overturn Plessy versus Ferguson. Now the real work begins. Earl Warren, as chief, gets the opportunity to decide whether he'll write the opinion for the court or whether, as chief justice, he'll assign the opinion. Of course, no chief is going to pass up the opportunity to write the historic decision in the greatest civil rights case of American history, and he writes the opinion. I said earlier that he's not known for being a great legal scholar, but he certainly was right when he wrote that segregation in public schools is, in fact, a violation of due process of law and equal protection. You cannot have separate facilities that are logically equal. They are not equal. Thus, he is taking a close look at the very principle of equal protection of the law. But the opinion becomes famous for what he did next. He said, let's consider the impact on the children here and the impact of segregation on America as a whole. When children, black children, are relegated to a separate classroom or a separate school, rather, they are being told by society, you're inferior, you don't deserve to be in the same classroom with white children. He said, drawing upon a lot of psychological literature, that this will certainly cause an inferiority complex, not only in those individuals, but it spreads out across America, telling African Americans that they are inferior at a time when in a democracy we want as much participation as we can get, when we want to spread power out as far as we can spread it, and it would be essentially an act to undermine not only our Constitution, the 14th Amendment, but our democratic values. So he writes the opinion. He took the rare step at the urging of his colleagues to only make one copy of the Supreme Court opinion. Why just one copy? Because he knew how America was holding its collective breath, waiting to hear how the court was going to rule, and he didn't want any copies to be leaked. The court had learned a hard lesson in 1929 when it had rendered a ruling that eventually was leaked and allowed some people to make a great deal of money on the stock market. This is before the crash, of course. And so the court took a clue from that and locked away Warren's opinion in a vault. On announcement day, when the Supreme Court announces its opinion, sometimes, but not very often, it will actually read the entire opinion, but that's very rare. More commonly, the Supreme Court will essentially just announce its decision. But Warren knew that all of America would want to know. So the courtroom was packed. Reporters were in the back of the room. when he began to read from his opinion, saying that segregation in public schools is unconstitutional, as a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, the reporters sitting in the back of the room bolted for the few phones that were on the wall of the Supreme Court building. Probably elbows were flying, reporters were pushing each other, wanting to get their story on the wire. He proceeded to finish reading it, and suddenly, as news swept across the nation, in Thomas Jefferson's words from another era, that decision, quote, rang like a fire bell in the night. Rang like a fire bell in the night. You know how it is if you're awakened at 3 a.m, you're startled. That was the impact on the South, because now its entire history, its culture, its society would be torn apart by a requirement of integration in public schools. You may well know that after the decision came down, that it was met with great opposition in the South. The South refused to implement the desegregation decision, refused to implement the new ruling that separate but equal is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court had not attached to its opinion any order of implementation. Why? It might seem odd to you. But it did not, precisely because some members of the court were very sensitive to the impact of their opinion, and they thought it would be throwing salt in the wounds if not only did the court say segregation in public schools is unconstitutional, but you're now ordered to implement the decision right now. So they withheld it. Probably was a mistake not to attach any implementation order, because the lack of implementation probably served to embolden Southern leaders, legislators who wrote manifestos passed by the legislators opposing the court's order. Nothing happened. A year later, 1955, the case comes back to the court. This time it is the sequel, Brown versus the Board of Education, number 2. And this time the court orders all states to comply with, quote, all deliberate speed. Still, the Southerners were resisting, digging in their heels, unwilling to comply, when you may know that the governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus, refused to open the doors of the high school in Little Rock, Arkansas, to young black children. In fact, he called out the National Guard to form a ring around the school to stop black students from entering. That represented a direct challenge to the President of the United States, Dwight Eisenhower, who now saw the state flaunting the principle of federalism, that under Article 6 of the Constitution, the Supremacy Clause, the laws of the United States are superior to the states. And even if states don't like them, they still have to abide by them. And that includes adhering to Supreme Court decisions. So now Eisenhower, who had to that point not lifted a finger to enforce the Supreme Court's decision, now calls out the Army Airborne, the 82nd Airborne Unit, to go down to Little Rock and keep the schools open. Now black students enter. Thus, integration was on its way. It's a long story. It would take a long time to explain the further developments in integration. But what was remarkable was that the Supreme Court reversed, essentially, the court's previous rulings that had paid no respect to the purpose of the 14th Amendment. Now the court was, at least in this area of public education, going to atone for the sins of the Supreme Court back in the 1883 civil rights cases and Plessy versus Ferguson and many, many others. A word about Eisenhower. In his memoirs, Chief Justice Earl Warren expressed his bitter resentment toward Eisenhower for not utilizing his tremendous popularity to support the Supreme Court's decision when it was rendered in 1954. And in fact, Warren goes on to tell the story that on the night before oral argument, before the court, that President Eisenhower had a little dinner party at the White House. He invited Chief Justice Earl Warren, and he invited the attorney representing the school board in Topeka, Kansas. He didn't invite the attorney for the NAACP, the great Thurgood Marshall. And so the three of them, over dinner, were essentially engaging in inappropriate talks about the case before the court. I should say, not Earl Warren, he wasn't, but the president was lobbying Earl Warren. And as Warren writes it, as they walked into the dining room, Warren writes, Eisenhower put his arm around my shoulders and he said to me, there's nothing wrong with the parents of these little white girls. They just don't want their daughters, quote, sitting next to some big black buck in the classroom. That's the President of the United States lobbying the Chief Justice, defending segregation. Warren was particularly bitter because if Eisenhower had lent his tremendous popularity to the cause of desegregation, Warren thought that probably would have helped walls to be taken down. But he didn't. He only acted when the state of Arkansas was challenging federal authority. The court's attention to equal protection then in that most dramatic case helped to set a tone for those who were now hopeful, finally, 100 years later, that maybe America could move forward and could begin to finally implement the very core principle of justice and fairness in this country, which is called equal protection under the law. Now, that's not the only area, by any means, in which equal protection grabs the headlines. Previously, a year or so ago, I talked about equal protection and women's rights. We'll do that again soon. And also the Equal Protection Clause applies to the to LGBT rights, same-sex marriage, for example. And it spilled over into other areas involving other persons of color. But this is the most dramatic example, at least until the same-sex marriage decision came down, Obergefell versus Hodges, I would have to say. The most dramatic example of the court embracing equal protection so as to advance the cause of integration for African Americans in public schools. Why, as a society, should we care about equal protection? Because what we recognize is this. If we don't say that we are supportive of and protective of equal protection, what we're essentially saying is we have one body of laws for white people and another body of laws for persons of color. Two Americas, two societies. More than that, we're saying some people matter, other people don't matter. We're saying equality for these folks, who cares about these folks? A criminal justice system for whites and whatever persons of color get, that's their problem. You see that we cannot begin to realize the dream of an egalitarian society premised on equal treatment of equals if we don't have equal protection of the law. And we recognize further that the failure to implement equal protection will sow great discord in the country and likely will lead to violence. After all, how can you blame a repressed people for engaging in violence when nothing else works, when they are told they're inferior, when they're subjugated to second or third class citizenship? Who would, for a lifetime, take it before they begin to engage in matters that they think can improve circumstances, which may improve violence? After all, there's a great historical literature in our tradition which said at the time of the founding, when the government grows tyrannical and violates the rights of the citizenry, after all other avenues of remedy are pursued and exhausted, there's nothing left but revolt. And that's how we justify the American Revolution, isn't it? So if that language, if those ideas, if in fact those arguments were persuasive to John Adams and Samuel Adams and Washington and Franklin and the rest, why wouldn't the same reasoning, the same arguments be applicable to the cause of those in America who were denied the benefits of equal protection, the law? In no way am I justifying violence, but you can understand that in light of our own tradition and own arguments, that those documents, those arguments, those traditions would be available to people who believed that their government had grown tyrannical and had deprived them of their constitutional rights as citizens. I'll stop here and hope that I've provoked some good questions, some troublesome questions. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. So let's see. Greg has the microphone, and so I'll just ask you to speak up since this is being recorded, please. Thank you, Greg.
I was wondering whether the 14th Amendment specifies it's equal protection just for citizens, or is it any people?
That's a very good question. Thank you. Is the 14th Amendment specified that it's just for citizens or all people here? There are a couple things to say. First of all, let's make clear that the 14th Amendment says that anybody born or naturalized within the United States is a citizen of the United States and of the state in which they live. That contemplates that the 14th Amendment is going to apply to citizens, right? But the Supreme Court historically has also said that the 14th Amendment, like the Bill of Rights, applies to everybody on our soil. So we don't draw distinctions when it comes to the 14th Amendment between citizens and non-citizens. We found that the nation had difficulty in the early days of the War on Terror as the courts rendered early rulings trying, in effect, to split the Bill of Rights. People accused don't get these rights. Other people get these rights. That's no way to go. And finally, the Supreme Court straightened that out in a couple of cases beginning in 06 and 07. But it had taken years for the Supreme Court to be able to clean up the mess created by lower federal courts. Thank you. What else do we have? Yeah, you're going to get your exercise here, Greg. We're going to come over here, and then we'll come over here, please. Thanks.
The word that is often debated in oral arguments is, what is a class of groups? And the reason I'm asking that question is, we know the gerrymander case is before the Supreme Court, and there's a debate right now about whether or not political party or being involved with a political party is a class. And if that is a class, does that challenge and affect our very core of the Electoral College, that is an unequal representation of class and a violation of the 14th Amendment?
Thank you. Several great questions there. So the first thing we want to say is that historically, the Supreme Court, when interpreting the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, to decide what level of protection should be afforded the party before the court or the group of the court, has, as you indicated, designated classes for protection. So beginning with the Korematsu case in 1944, one of the three Japanese internment cases, the court introduced what's known as the strict scrutiny doctrine, which says that if, in effect, people of an origin other than Caucasian are, in fact, being denied their rights, that they now fall into what we call a suspect class, making race a suspect class. What does that mean? That means that a class may not be denied equal protection or due process of law on the basis of class or race, and later the court would add age, for example, and ethnic origin. So that strict scrutiny doctrine says any time that the government is going to pass a law or implement a program or regulation that has an impact on a suspect class, such as race, then the government is required to demonstrate a, quote, compelling governmental purpose for the enactment of the statute or the program, thus raising the bar of proof, raising the standard that the government has to meet in order to justify passing a law that has an impact on a particular group based on premises of race. Now, the question, that's the background, because when you ask about gerrymandered decisions coming before the court and whether parties can receive 14th Amendment protection and perhaps what level of protection, we'd want to note that in earlier gerrymandering cases involving segregation of white from black voters, that the court utilized the strict scrutiny doctrine to say, in effect, that the gerrymandering here has worked great harm on African-American voters, and so using that same reasoning of the strict scrutiny doctrine has knocked down these gerrymandering laws. Now, how does that apply to this case? It seems to me that the court is going to be able to make the same equal protection argument to strike down gerrymandering cases, for example, the one coming out of Wisconsin, among others, on the grounds that the principle of equal protection is violated, the principle of one man, one vote, and the influence that is attached to one person, one vote is violated when in fact districts are gerrymandered for extremely partisan reasons. So I think that there will be a majority to do that on the grounds that equal protection principles are violated. Now, why would I say that? I could well be wrong, but I don't think so. But if you go back to Bush versus Gore, remember that pretty controversial decision which decided after the 2000 election who would sit in the White House, whether it would be George W. Bush, or do you remember Al Gore? When we dealt with hanging chads and the inability of people serving on the committees to discern whether the vote was cast for this guy or that guy, then the state officials, Democrats, ordered a recount, and it was ordered a recount, and then Republicans tried to stop the recount, and it finally went to the Supreme Court, and the court stopped the recount, officially stopped the recount of all those contested ballots. The reason why the court stopped it was because it said if these committees counting the ballots proceed, there will be great concerns about the equal protection clause here, that voters will not be protected because the counting could be arbitrary. It might not, in fact, be uniform. What is a hanging chad that looks like this? How does that compare to a hanging chad that looks like this and this? So the court elevated the equal protection clause in that case so as to stop a vote count, treating the equal protection clause as cutting across all lines, thus viewing parties as worthy of equal protection under the 14th Amendment. If the court were to follow the reasoning of its own case, its own decision, in Bush versus Gore, then I think it would, in fact, render a similar ruling. Now, the problem with that is that when the court rendered that highly controversial opinion, Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote for the court, "This decision does not constitute a precedent and provides no basis for any future cases." Well, why would the court do that? Everything the court does can establish a precedent. It was because of the extremely political nature of the case. So, having in that case held that parties are worthy of protection under the Equal Protection Clause, whether or not the court follows Bush versus Gore as a precedent, I think that same little bit of reasoning should apply in the gerrymandered case so as to strike down the gerrymandering practices which are based on extremely partisan reasons. Good question. Thank you. Yes, where are you, Greg? Down here. Thank you.
Hi, I have a question about the travel ban, and I'd like to see if I can say this right. You know, it's been going back and forth in the courts, and now it's kind of scaring me. They're saying that the Trump people have reworded it, so it's getting more compliant, but yet, and what they're kind of focusing on is his statement of national security. But to me, I don't know why it's not going to the Japanese and how they were treated, and because there's so many people, they're vetted so strongly, and I think they have proof statistically on how much crimes they've committed compared to the amount of crimes that are happening every day in the United States. So I don't see why that isn't kind of pertinent to what you're talking about.
Very good points. So you're all aware that the President Trump's travel ban in its third iteration is now before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court heard oral argument today. This is a very important case bearing not only on immigration, but bearing on the scope of presidential power and national security. So in this case, which is brought by Hawaii, the state of Hawaii argued that the travel ban initially in the first two iterations on what was essentially a ban on Muslims entering the country wounds the state of Hawaii and hurts individuals. And the argument is, from the standpoint of Hawaii, is that the ban is essentially an outright ban on Muslims, and that constitutes a violation of the religion clauses of the First Amendment. It's gross religious bias. Then they can look at the statute and say, the statute in play, which delegates to the president broad authority to ban people from entering this country if he believes that they represent a national security threat to the nation, also includes a provision that says that but the president may not ban people based on place of residence or country from which they come. So you have two competing clauses, two clauses which may be in conflict. One, the president has broad authority to determine who might represent a national security threat, and if he determines that those people coming from these countries that have been on the banned list since the beginning represent a threat, then in effect he would appear to have statutory authority to deny their admission to the country. However, that other clause says, but the president may not consider place of residence, the state from which they come. This is why the lower courts have struck down President Trump's ban on several occasions, because he's never provided an explanation for why he believes that people from these Muslim countries represent a national security threat. Because as the state of Hawaii has pointed out through its legal counsel, there is no record of anybody from these countries having engaged in acts of violence against the United States. Whereas people from other countries which are not on the banned list have in fact engaged in terrorist acts against the United States. So if President Trump is truly interested in national security, why aren't these other countries on the banned list? And then when you couple that with his many pronouncements through tweets and words from podiums and his campaign that he did, in fact, want to ban Muslims for the country, they're saying that his tweets and his public statements do count because they reveal his intention, and that, therefore, the court should understand that, in fact, President Trump's ban is all about religious discrimination. Now, what we saw in oral argument today is that at least a couple of justices are warmer to the idea that the president has broad authority to act in what he perceives to be the national security interest of the country, and if he determines that people from other countries will pose a national security threat, he can ban them. The problem with this is that in many ways that these justices, I suspect, are drawing upon a checkered record over 75 years of of a misconceived understanding about the scope of the president's power over foreign affairs. The court got it wrong in a 1936 case called United States versus Curtis Wright, in which the court unfortunately characterized in dictum, characterized the president as the sole organ of American foreign policy, thus attributing to him very broad authority. But those dicta, were in complete defiance of the text of the Constitution, the aims of the framers, Federalist Papers, early Supreme Court decisions. We never had any court ever saying that the president was the sole organ and could make those decisions unilaterally. But since then, and this is a deep, complex story, but since then, the court has largely followed that. So if the justices in this case decide to follow that flawed history and exhibit great deference to the president's determination of what constitutes national security, they may well uphold his order, even though this case is really about the meaning of the statute. The statute requires him to explain why people coming in pose a national security harm, and he's not done that. Why should this case be about a statute rather than a broader claim of the president's national security authority? Because historically, going all the way back to 1933, when Justice Brandeis introduced what's become known as the Brandeis rule of interpretation, the court should answer questions in the most narrow way, not in the broadest way. And the court can satisfactorily resolve this case in an efficient, narrow way by looking at the statute and saying Trump has not justified the ban on Muslim countries in terms that meet the requirements of the statute, because he's adduced no evidence at all, not a single case, of anybody from these banned countries engaging in any violence or representing a threat to the country. But I have to say, unfortunately, that the court has for 75 years shown unusual deference to the president when it comes to foreign policy. Instead of learning its lesson, to your final point now, instead of learning its lesson, we learned a bitter lesson as a nation when the court in the Korematsu case in 1944 upheld President Roosevelt's executive order to remove Japanese Americans from their homes on the grounds that a couple of guys in the military had falsely claimed that Japanese American citizens would represent a threat to America's security, that they would be more loyal to the Japanese Empire than the United States. When we later learned that these reports on which Congress relied in passing a statute, on which Roosevelt relied in issuing the executive order, were complete falsehood. No evidence of any espionage, treason, disloyalty. So the court should have learned its lesson then. We don't show blanket deference to the military and its representation of a national security threat. Fine, we can say we're going to respect that, and we will, if all things being equal, we'll defer to the military, but we've got to see some evidence. We've got to see some justification, whether it was in Korematsu or in this case. On the other hand, perhaps some members of the Supreme Court, like legal counsel for the government, would say the court doesn't have the authority to second-guess the president when it comes to national security matters. Well, that gets it wrong. The court is not asked to second-guess the president's decision. It's a saying to the president, give us some evidence of why you think there's a national security threat. You can't come to this court and say, well, people from those six or eight countries represent a national security threat because I say so. We don't run in a constitutional system. We don't run on the basis of a series of ipsy dixits. It's legal because I say so. We demand some evidence, some justification. That's what the statute requires. At a minimum, that's what the court, even those who are going to support Trump, they should still require some evidence as to why the president considers people from those countries to represent a national security threat. I'm not hopeful. This is an area in which I've done a lot of writing, and I'm eternally frustrated about it. But the court simply doesn't want to be in the position of overruling a president's action in foreign affairs and national security, because if the court gets it wrong and stops the president and a tragedy occurs, then the court will be left holding the bag. It will be blamed. Presidents know that, so they exploit that fear, that uncertainty. Thank you. Any other questions? Back here, please. Thank you. Right.
So this afternoon I listened to a pretty disturbing interview with an author who just wrote a book about militia groups that adhere to Christian identity philosophies and white nationalism. Now, I mean, it's, you know, following on from a Muslim ban, I'm disturbed that attention to these groups is surprisingly absent from the administration, presumably because they're not very far removed from Trump's base. But if any of these groups actually carry out some kind of event, such as the Oklahoma bombing, which apparently was part of that movement, does the 14th Amendment get dragged into this, or is it just treated as terrorism or murder? Is it treated as an equal rights issue because the underlying philosophy is one of cleansing the nation of anything not white?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a fascinating question. Thank you. So the first thing we would say is the 14th Amendment only applies to state laws. So in these circumstances, if there are laws that are going to punish hate groups or churches masquerading as authentic religions that but are filled with an hateful ideology based on the premise that the people whom they're criticizing, blacks, Native Americans, Japanese, you name it, then they can be viewed as representing a threat. But until they actually engage in a violent action, they're fully protected by the 14th Amendment and by freedom of speech, and in this case, freedom of religion, unless or until they engage in violent action, right? Because up until that point, they're in the marketplace of ideas with mainstream Republicans and Democrats, extolling the alleged virtues of their doctrines of racism or sexism or whatever it might be. They can make those arguments without having to fear being punished or arrested. But the moment that they would engage in violent action, then they leave that sphere of speech and enter the realm of action, and that's when they can be subject to criminal penalties. When you were talking about that, it reminded me of an article that ran in yesterday's Idaho Statesman about a number of churches here in Idaho and across the nation that really masquerade as religions, and they're spewing all kinds of ideological hate, and how they're being monitored as hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center, located in Alabama, which has done great work. As you know, it did great work to bring down the Aryan Church in northern Idaho 20 years or so ago. And we need those kinds of watchdog groups, like the Southern Poverty Law Center, and to monitor these groups. And the Law Center distinguishes violent from nonviolent, but even a nonviolent hate group is still on that watch list because, as they point out, a group can move from the nonviolent to the violent category pretty darn quickly, whether it's an example of Timothy McVeigh building a bomb in Oklahoma City and so forth. So I'm happy that they're doing that. Yeah. Did that address the points in your question? It did? Okay. Thank you. How are we doing? Any other? We're about out of time. We have time for couple more questions. Thank you. Here, first.
Recently, I heard on NPR a bunch of folks that had lived through some of the Brown decision, and these were black folks that said that they went about it incorrectly, that they looked totally at the students, and what happened out of integration was they had schools that had black teachers in them, and the black teachers ended up all being fired as they integrated into the white schools. Which was a totally different take I had on it, but they were saying that they put black students in white schools that then they had nobody to talk to, and they were always being sort of treated differently in the white schools. Yeah. And I don't know if you've heard of this before, or I think that's probably still something of a problem.
Let's not be naive about this. We understand that racism is very prevalent in this country, and we still have decisions made on the basis of race and ethnic background, and we still have to fight to overcome these practices and this general ignorance, frankly. But you're right to bring up that policy. You don't strike a blow for integration and an end to segregation by firing African-American teachers as you mingle whites and blacks. If anything, the school district should distribute teachers, and people should be teaching at different schools. But, as you may know, that decision in some school districts was animated by hate, anger over the court's decision, and so they did it in a spiteful way. They said, fine, you want integration? We'll fire African-American teachers, and we'll put white teachers in here. It's a big, big subject. And a difficult, complicated subject, but one that we have to stay vigilant about and we have to continue to discuss at every opportunity. Over here, please. Did you still have a question? Okay, just a second, please, then. Okay. Please.
Yeah. I just had a comment. You brought up Linda Brown, and just wanted to note that she passed away 1 month ago today.
Yes, thank you. I knew it was about a month ago, but today. Yep, I see. Yeah. Today. Wow. How about that? That's a milestone, isn't it? Yeah. Thanks. And one last comment here, I think, before we adjourn for the evening.
My comment is the segregation of schools was not only in the South.
Right.
When my family was following the crops and they worked in California, Southern California, the schools there were segregated. Mexicans and blacks went to one school, and whites went to another school. The school for the whites had lawn, and they had nice buses. The schools for the Mexicans and blacks had no lawn, and they had rickety buses. My sister has shared with me about some of the wealthier farmers lived way out, and, of course, their children were coming in on the nice buses. Well, they didn't want to send a second bus, so they'd pick up the Mexican kids, too, along the way. But then they would get, when they got to the white school, then they would transfer the Mexican kids to a rickety bus to go to their school. And so, and this was in the 1940s. And, and I'm sure the same thing was happening in northern cities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still happening. You know, to me, all the charter schools that are cropping up are a de facto segregation.
Thank you for those comments. So just on one point on that, you're exactly right. Segregation was not consigned solely to the South. There were many northern cities. Boston, of course, was a very troubled city, troubled with racist history. We still find it elsewhere. So it is an immense problem, and we'll never achieve the goal of equal protection under the law or the concept of equality for all until we beat back all the racism. And what we've seen, unfortunately, just in the last year or so, going back at least to the incident at Charlottesville, is a resurrection, very open displays of the worst kind of racial prejudice by the KKK, by the Nazis, etc. I don't use the term neo-Nazis because, in my view, they are the Nazis, so I don't want to distinguish them. They behave in the same kind of way. Well, we'll have a chance, I hope, to meet again in several weeks when we renew some series. Please pay attention to any emails you receive from the Altruist Institute. Check out our newly revised website that will be up and running on May 1, and please do consider the May 17 event. You'll like it. Among the local women who are remarkable, we have Rebecca Casper, and we have Katie Stokes, the editorial page editor. We have Amy Linz of the Idaho National Lab, who's the director of governmental relations, and others, and nationally prominent women whom you've seen on television many times in some films would include Kathleen Tarr, the vice provost for undergraduate education at Stanford, who is a recording artist and an actress who holds records in the marathon and has a degree from Harvard Law School, and she's been quoted by federal courts. She's a truly remarkable African-American woman. And Dr. Caroline Heldman, whom you've seen on a lot of national television shows, who was a co-founder of the National Organization to Combat Sexual Assault on College Campuses, and also an author and an opera singer and a black belt. You have to be respectful around her. Anyway, please come. You'll enjoy them as all of them talk about that great theme resonating across America, finding your voice. It's a universal theme of interest and appeal. So thanks, everybody. We'll see you all soon. Thanks for coming. Thank you. Thank you.